From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the end of the Education Achievement Authority and lessons learned from the state's reform school district.
The state of Michigan has a very poor track record in turning schools around.
An Ypsilanti mom shares her story of domestic abuse so hidden even her mother didn't know.
The physical abuse was a surprise to her and everyone that we knew because on the surface, we had a beautiful home, we had nice cars, we had beautiful children.
The Trump budget threatens the USDA's Rural Development Office. We'll see what that could mean for rural towns in Michigan.
If our administration is really going to place the kind of priority on economic development and job creation and building our small communities, this is where it needs to be done.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Rural communities everywhere rely on small grants from the federal government for economic stimulus.
Providing everything from loan guarantees for business, direct loans to nonprofits to do things like purchase buildings and expand their operations, rehabilitating portions of communities and downtowns.
And the list goes on. Later this hour, what possible cuts to the USDA Rural Development Office could mean for small towns in Michigan. But first, the state's experiment in running a school district ends this week. The Education Achievement Authority, the EAA, ceases to exist as of Friday. Its 15 schools will be absorbed into the Detroit Public Schools Community District. Let's look at its legacy and what we can learn. Bridge Magazine's Chastity Pratt-Dawsey has covered the ins and outs of the EAA since it began 6 years ago. Chastity, remind us again, why was this all begun?
You have across the nation states that have what are called recovery school districts, reform school districts. The most popular one is the reform school district in Louisiana. And the idea is when schools really can't pull their stuff together, the state pulls all of those schools from different districts that need help into one district. So the idea was we're going to take all of our least performing schools, put them in one special reform district and give them attention, resources, school improvement plans, and fix them up. And in a few years, if they're doing well, we'll send those schools back to their home districts to be basically administered again.
And is this how, did it work well in, let's say, Louisiana, other areas? Is that how it has worked out?
It's worked out somewhat in Louisiana. They do it a little differently. They've chartered most of the schools in the recovery school district in Louisiana. That's not the way that it went here with the EAA. And Tennessee has a reform district. They do things a little differently as well. So, I mean, the impetus and the spirit of a reform school district might be the same in different states, but the way they are administered, the way they're put into play are different. And here in Michigan, it was really different, had some problems from the beginning. So it's no surprise that it didn't work out well.
Break those down for us. What problems were inherent in the creation of the EAA?
Well, from the beginning, the idea was we're going to use an educational platform that had not been used in any urban district in any wide scale. They adopted a learning platform that they called Buzz. It was online. You were supposed to be able to sit a classroom of kids in front of a computer, and the computer would differentiate their learning. So it would say, oh, Cynthia, you need more help with reading. Chastity, you need more help with, you know, phonics or spelling. And it would give the same lesson, but, you know, curtail it to each child's needs. Well, it never was fully implemented. Teachers were never fully trained on it. After a couple of years, it just went away. And the other really huge challenge was the EAA started off with maybe 25-30% of its teachers being Teach for America. And these are teachers who are straight out of college. So you had a situation where the EAA, Education Achievement Authority, is educating students who need the most help. They're in the bottom 5% of schools in the state, but 25% or more of their teachers are novices. So you had the kids who need the most getting the least experienced teachers. That didn't prove to work out very well for the EAA either.
And when we say didn't work out very well, what did we see in terms of scores?
So over the past 6 years, you had 15 schools that were in the EIA. Remember, the EIA was supposed to be a statewide district. It could have grown to 100 or so schools. There were school districts across the state that vigorously fought having their schools placed in the EIA. So it didn't become a statewide reform district. It stayed clustered in Detroit with those first 15 schools that it started with. And so those first 15 schools that the EIA started with in Detroit, they were all in the bottom 5% in the state. And here we are 6 years later, only three of those schools have gotten off of the bottom 5% list.
And we got a note here. We had the state coming in and taking over schools in a district that was already under state control. Should the state be in the business of turnaround like this?
This was a double takeover. You're absolutely right, Cynthia. The Detroit Public Schools were already under state takeover. Then the state removes 15 schools and puts them in a state reform district. And neither of those experiments worked out well for Detroit. The EIA is, like you said, is being shut down on June 30th, and those schools are being returned to the Detroit Public School District. And the Detroit Public School District, you know, after 17, 18 years on again, off again state reform, is, you know, still gasping and lost 100,000 students, closed 100 schools, is, you know, academically among the nation's worst. So the state of Michigan has a very poor track record in turning schools around.
So it sounds like the experts who say this is a train wreck, lackluster at best, are right on track.
Well, the state has dirty hands in this, and there's going to have to be a statewide effort. When I mean statewide, I mean everyone in Lansing, from the tip of the Upper Peninsula to the bottom of the Mitten. There has to be some, I guess I want to say, mission to improve education across the state. All ships have to rise. We have one of the most mediocre and failing school systems in the state of Michigan, and Detroit is, you know, at the bottom of the list nationally. This is not just a problem in Detroit. It's a statewide problem, education in Michigan.
Chastity Pratt-Dossie, Bridge Magazine, as always, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Nir Sar is with us now. He's the principal of Mumford Academy in Northwest Detroit, one of the 15 Detroit schools in the EAA. Nir, are you at all sorry to see the EAA dissolve?
I think I am, to a certain extent. I think that the EAA has offered me, at least, the kind of structure and systems and autonomy to fulfill a dream of mine, frankly. I mean, to start my own school and to try to, you know, achieve exceptional results in Detroit, which has been elusive for decades. So, yeah, I am kind of sad to see it go. Even given all the ups and downs and the history of it before I got here, I think there was a lot of good in the EAA that could be lost if not transitioned carefully.
All right, let's talk about what you've seen right there on the front lines, as it were, at the Mumford Academy. What worked with the EAA?
I came on 2 years ago, so the fall of 2015. And I think what I found even through the interview process was a district that was willing to try new things, but do so kind of thoughtfully and carefully. So when I was hired, the idea was posed to start a new school within Mumford High School, within the existing building, that could reset culture and expectations, and that would be an approach different than trying to turn around the entire school all at once. So I think my experience has been one of stepping into an organization with really smart people, people whose primary objective is to support principals and teachers kind of almost directly and exclusively, which is not always the mindset of a district. So it's been my experience that they not only have come up with good ideas and found good people to kind of support them, but really given a lot of autonomy at the school level to fulfill some of these lofty goals and expectations.
I'm curious about what you felt didn't work, because certainly the EAA was pretty roundly criticized. For example, Michigan State University education professor David Arson calls the EAA, in his words, a train wreck of an educational policy. What didn't work?
Granted, I think my perspective is limited in that I joined the EAA 2 years ago and wasn't there from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But my best, I guess, articulation of it would be to split the EAA into two kind of periods, the initial period under Covington's leadership, and then once Veronica Conforme took over.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, at least based on what I heard from people that I knew coming out of the EAA, I was privy to all the challenges with oversized classrooms and strained models, technology not being in place, kind of all the things that I think we typically read about. But what I found when I came on board was kind of a very different mindset and structure to the EAA. So I think, yeah, certainly not everything worked. Areas of growth or challenge still really remained getting the level of autonomy and flexibility that, for instance, charter schools have. And I think that with that autonomy has to be a certain level of accountability. So finding that balance between autonomy and support is crucial at times. Misplaced potentially within the district.
Near the Mumford Academy is going to be absorbed into the Detroit Public Schools Community District. Could you have made another choice and taken it elsewhere?
No. So Mumford Academy is a part of Mumford High School. It is one school code, so on paper it is one school. Internally, we've divided it for the purpose of kind of resetting culture, resetting expectations. And since we've done so, we've achieved the highest reading and math growth scores in the district last year and had some very strong attendance rates. There was never an option to take Mumford Academy elsewhere, but it would be up to, you know, the new district, to DPSCD, to kind of decide what model they want to pursue. And thankfully, it feels like we have a lot of support from the district, the Alumni Association, to keep things as they are with Mumford Academy staying in existence under its current structure.
And what are your hopes for the new superintendent, Nicolai Vitti?
So I have very high hopes for him. Actually, in the several conversations I've had with him, I've been impressed. I can tell you that, as is, you know, well documented, a lot of people coming from the EAA to DPSCD are taking kind of significant pay cuts. And so part of my decision to stay on board was first and foremost my love for my team and my students, but also his vision and what I think his leadership will look like. And I'll say that I feel very encouraged that he gets the autonomy piece. He gets that we need to be data-driven and, you know, results-oriented. And I think that he's putting students and teachers first, maybe for the first time in a while.
And your hopes for the Mumford Academy, now that it's the EA is going away, as you look ahead to the new school year, I know that the Mumford Academy had been on that state list of threatened schools as far as performance. What are you thinking looking ahead?
We're really excited for the future at Mumford Academy. So for the last 2 years, we, again, had the highest reading and math growth scores in the EAA district, and those are with our 9th and 10th graders. So next year will be the first year that we have juniors taking the SAT and the MSTEP, the state test. So we're really excited. I mean, our mission has been to make Mumford Academy the best open enrollment high school in Detroit. I think we can get there. I think as long as we get the support from the district and the consistency and autonomy that we need, I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to achieve that goal in a couple of years.
Nir Sar is the principal of the Mumford Academy. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Nir.
Thank you.
Up next, summer means Shakespeare and a whole lot more on stage in theaters across Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
To be or not to be? That is the question.
Time now for another edition of Theater Talk as we turn to David Kiley of Encore Michigan, taking us around the state to look at productions from professional theater companies. And we're going to start right out with the Bard.
That's right. It's summer Shakespeare time. So the Michigan Shakespeare Festival is just about to be upon us. And trust me, if you want tickets, get them now on the festival's website, which is MichiganShakespeareFestival.com, because the three productions they are doing are going to be very popular.
Which is, I love hearing you say, you want this, move quickly.
Yeah.
So it's great to know that there is an appetite out there for,
absolutely,
for Shakespeare.
So The Taming of the Shrew begins July 6th at the Bauman Theater in Jackson. And then also at the Bauman, starting on July 8th, Julius Caesar begins. And then as the festival always does a non-Shakespeare play, it will be Anton Chekhov's The Seagull on July 13th. But you need to go to the website and pick your dates because, first of all, the shows run concurrently. The order changes each weekend. So you kind of have to organize your outings.
And then they're going to move to Canton later,
they move
right?
to Canton later to make it more accessible for Eastsiders. But these are two of the most accessible Shakespeare plays of all. I don't think I have to explain Julius Caesar to anyone.
Well, certainly it's been making headlines over the summer thanks to the New York Shakespeare in the Park Donald Trump themed Caesar.
Yes,
this is not that.
No, it's not that. But, you know, friends, Romans, countrymen, yep. Lend me your ear. And then Taming of the Shrew is also one of Shakespeare's great comedies, featuring a love story and trickery and mistaken identity, all the big classic Shakespeare devices in his comedies. And some people might not know that both the Broadway show Kiss Me, Kate, and also the film 10 Things I Hate About You
with Julia Stiles
are based on Taming of the Shrew.
Let's take a listen to a clip from Taming of the Shrew from the Michigan Shakespeare Company production.
Come, come, you wasp. In faith, you are too angry.
If I be waspish, best beware my sting.
My remedy, then, is to pluck it out.
Aye, if the fool could find where it lies.
Who knows not where a wasp does wear his sting? In his tail.
In his tongue.
Whose tongue?
Yours, if you talk of tails. And so, farewell.
What? With my tongue in your tail?
And, of course, that Kate.
So, and then Anton Chekhov's Seagull, which is the first of the Russian playwright's major plays, focuses on both the romantic and artistic conflicts among characters. This production has been adapted for an ensemble of 12 actors. This is a classic, and this is a world premiere for this particular translation. And then, as we said, on July 28th, the show's moved to Canton.
So Southeast Michigan, you can hit it easily.
That's right. And both these theaters, the Village Theater in Canton and the Bauman in Jackson, are wonderful, wonderful venues. And these are two very popular plays.
And there's actually some more Shakespeare on offer.
That's right. I suggest people take a look at seeing King Lear at the Interlaken Shakespeare Festival at the Interlaken Center for the Arts. This is a classic Shakespeare work, of course, which a lot of scholars believe is his best play. And these performances begin on June 30th, and they run July 1st, 7th, and 8th.
Now we head over to the Purple Rose in Chelsea.
Yes. I just had the pleasure of seeing and reviewing Harvey, a play that actually most people probably know the movie with James Stewart.
Of course.
But this is a play that actually won the Pulitzer Prize and beat out the Glass Menagerie, little fun fact, believe it or not. And it's about Elwood P. Dowd, who has a friend who's a 6'3" anthropomorphic rabbit that only he sees. It's a light drama, and it's a terrific play. And, of course, you know, with Purple Rose, they've handled it really well with wonderful actors. Richard McWilliams plays Elwood, and Michelle Mountain plays Avia, his very high-strung sister. It was very good. My review is up on Encore Michigan.
Now we go over to a young theater company in Ann Arbor, the Kickshaw Theater. We've actually had the founders here on Stateside when they first launched. So what are they doing this summer?
They're doing a new play called Really. And they have moved their venues around, so it'll be on June 29th at the Trust Arts Studios on Jackson Road in Ann Arbor, just west of the Baker Road exit. And you can get all that info, of course, on Encore Michigan. Really is by Jackie Sibley's Drury, is the playwright. It's about a young photographer and her artist boyfriend and his mother. But the play sort of quickly becomes a focus on the photographer and the mother. And I think it's a very special play and one to see from a very interesting playwright. And Kickshaw, young but rising company, they've been moving around a bit, but I think people will enjoy this a lot.
And you've got something for fans of musicals, because in Pinckney, what's being done?
Well, it's a very fun show at the Dio Theater. It's a dinner theater called Forever Plaid. It's a jukebox musical about a group of four singers who in 1964 are fatally killed in a car accident on their way to their big gig.
Which sounds like a gloomy thing.
It sounds gloomy and however, this is a show that's really the device. This show is based on groups like the Four Freshmen, you know, those harmony groups from the early 60s, kind of before the British invasion. So it's all of that era. And the songs include pieces like Crazy Batch of Baby, Lady of Spain, Rags to Riches, Heart and Soul. They do a great job with the material. There's a particularly fabulous scene where they act out like a whole season of the Ed Sullivan Show in like 3 minutes. And it's a delightful, happy, upbeat show, even though the boys are in heaven. Yeah.
Let's take a listen to a bit of the original cast recording from Forever Plaid.
We're used to doing our next tune with the choreography.
So, with your permission, we'll be doing it the way we rehearsed it.
In the stock room of my family's plumbing supply company.
So we'll be using these really big plungers that we pretend are microphones. Okay?
Okay.
On the shelf. Give me all your love and all that you can afford. Let me keep you always near the Jimmy and Dore. Crazy about your baby. Crazy about your baby. Crazy about your baby. Want you all to myself.
So what did you think of this production at the Dio Dinner Theater? You reviewed it.
It's great fun. It's just great fun. And the boys do a terrific job with their vocals. It's really... When you have four actors who can really sing harmony and mix in comedy patter and, you know, and tell the story, it was a delightful evening.
I'm guessing this might appeal to theatergoers of a certain age.
Yes, I would say, you know, certainly people who remember that kind of pre-British invasion, kind of very innocent kind of stuff. But
yes.
There were some younger folks that night that I went to review it, and everybody seemed to have a good time.
So. All right. So just to recap, the Michigan Shakespeare Festival offering Julius Caesar, The Taming of the Shrew, and Chekhov's The Seagull, and they're starting out in Jackson and then moving to Canton. And again, you're saying if you want tickets, you got to move?
Yes, because, again, not only is the Michigan Shakespeare Festival terrific, but these plays are very popular whenever they come around.
And let's not forget King Lear at the Interlochen Shakespeare Festival. And then the Kickshaw Theater in Ann Arbor is doing a new play, Really. The Purple Rose in Chelsea is doing Harvey. And the Dio Dinner Theater in Pinckney offering Forever Plaid. And you can get details on these and other productions around Michigan. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley of Encore Michigan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. It was 35 years ago this month since the murder of a young Chinese-American man named Vincent Chin. He was beaten to death outside a Highland Park bar by two white men, an auto worker and his stepson. Vincent Chin's death and the subsequent plea bargain and lenient sentences the killers received sparked an Asian-American activist movement with protests in cities all across the U.S., The BBC's Farhana Haider has been speaking to Helen Zia, one of the activists leading this fight for justice.
We want justice! We want justice! We want
On June the 19th, 1982, Vincent Chin, a 27-year-old engineer, was at his bachelor party in Detroit when he got into a fight with Ronald Ebens, an auto worker, and his stepson, Michael Nitz. Witnesses said the men mistook him for a Japanese person and used racial slurs. They were also said to have shouted, "It's because of you we are out of work."
Mr. Evans and Mr. Nitz jumped out from behind the truck, attempted to grab Vincent Chin. I identified myself as a police officer. I showed him a badge and an ID card. I had my weapon drawn. I asked him to drop the baseball bat.
When we pulled up, we found that it was an Oriental gentleman. His skull was obviously fractured, and Chin was... obviously in a fatal condition. He wasn't dead yet, but, you know, from my experience of being on the street for so long, the man was a goner.
Vincent was in a coma for 4 days and died on the 23rd of June, 1982. His funeral took place on what should have been his wedding day. In the early 1980s, the U.S. was in the grips of an economic depression. The unemployment rate was at its highest since World War II, and Japan was getting the blame.
I can only describe it as mirroring the Islamophobia that poured out as a hysteria in America after 9/11, except instead of being against people who, you know, quote, look Muslim, back then it was anybody who looked Japanese.
Helen Zia, a Chinese American, had moved to Detroit in 1977.
Asian Americans were largely invisible, were seen as foreign invaders, as though we were there to do harm to America. And 1982 was also a time of intense hatred against Japan, Japanese, and anybody who looked Japanese because of the economy, and that we were to blame. Every time a newspaper came out or a news report on the radio or television, it would be just full of bile and fury toward people who look like us, the enemy.
Choked by imports and fighting for survival, the American auto industry and its army have targeted Japan as a major source of its problems.
We are being shot at and shot up by the Japanese, who have the most protectionist economy in the world.
Japan was perceived to be flooding the U.S. with its cars, and this was felt particularly hard in Detroit, the car-making capital of America.
So the depression in the United States, but the epicenter in Detroit, was incredibly bleak, and that was the climate when Vincent was killed.
And Helen, when did you first hear about the death of Vincent Chin?
I heard about Vincent Chin's death the same time most everybody else did. I read it in a newspaper. It was on the front pages of the Detroit Free Press. It had a picture of Vincent, his fiance, and his mother. And in Detroit in 1982, there were so few Asian Americans, so seeing a picture of an Asian American who had been killed, that was a shock. You know, I'm Chinese American, as was Vincent Chin, but looking like he could be Japanese, just even walking on the street, anybody with an Asian face knew that they could be a target.
Ronald Eben and his stepson, Michael Netz, never denied killing Vincent Chin, but they insisted the matter was simply a barroom brawl that had ended badly and not a hate crime. They pleaded guilty to manslaughter, and in March 1983, they were sentenced to 3 years probation and fined $3,000.
And the judge, when he pronounced the probation and fine, said that these are not the kind of men you send to jail. They are clean-cut men. They're not going to do this again. Basically, he was giving them a free pass to kill somebody, and in this case, a Chinese-American. I was enraged. I thought, I have to do something. One of the articles interviewed some representatives in the Chinese-American community. And I, as a young reporter, saw the names of the two Chinese Americans, and I called the two gentlemen up and I just said, I want to do something. What can we do? You know, I'm a journalist. I know a little bit about press conferences and things like that. How can I help? So they invited me to meet with them. And when I got there, there was a young Chinese American lawyer named Lisa Chan. We hadn't seen any police records yet. The young attorney, Lisa Chan, who was there, briefed us about what legal options could happen, and we all agreed we needed to involve the community. We went from a meeting of 4 people to 10 people to 50 people. We formed an organization that we named American Citizens for Justice because we saw that it was beyond the Chinese community in Detroit and that it needed to be broader. And we went up to having meetings of 300 people showing up in a big auditorium to actually talk about what could be done. This was the first time that Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, it was the first time we had come together.
They began to organize rallies and protests across the U.S. from New York to San Francisco. Remember Vincent Chin and Justice for Vincent Chin became rallying cries.
Justice for Vincent Chin! Justice for Vincent Chin!
The 11:30 rally began with a list of speakers nearly a page long waiting to add their personal support and that of many organizations to the cause of justice for Vincent Chin.
I am really grateful. We all work really hard to get justice for my son, Vincent.
Their main demand was that there be a government investigation into Vincent Chin's death. And as a result of their activism, it was soon underway.
Early 1984, the federal government announced that it would begin a federal investigation to see whether race had played a part in the killing of Vincent Chin.
And how did you feel when that was announced, when they said that investigation would happen?
I felt like we had overcome a great hurdle, that there was a governmental authority that actually said, okay, we're listening. We will look into this. This was an enormous validation of our humanity for the entire Asian American community in the United States. It was really a movement across America and beyond. Papers in Hong Kong and China and Japan were following this case.
In 1984, federal prosecutors took Ronald Ebens and Michael Netz to court for violating Vincent Chin's civil rights. Ebens was convicted and sentenced to 25 years in prison. But this victory was short-lived when, on May 1, 1987, the conviction was overturned on appeal.
The feeling of that day when the not guilty verdict was announced was just, it was devastating. and exacerbated just by the grief of Vincent's mother, who really had been a moral authority through the whole process, through all those years. She would say, our skin might be different, but our blood is the same. And the day that Vincent's killer was let off, she was heartbroken. And it was the hardest thing for me to have to say to Mrs. Chin, who I became very close with. She asked me, Helen, isn't there something more we can do? And I had to say to her, no, this was it.
Despite the fact that Vincent's killers ultimately did not serve any jail time, Helen believes Vincent's death had a lasting impact on civil rights and the rights of immigrants in America.
Vincent was an immigrant, and there was a question whether federal civil rights law would protect an Asian in America and an immigrant in America. And so the fact that the federal government took it up was an opening for all Americans. And now federal civil rights law protects on the issue of gender, sexual orientation, and disability, and immigrants are protected. So I really think for all of Americans, there were many changes stemming from this Vincent Chin case that really affect all of us and really expanded the notion of what the value of a human life is and how federal law should protect that. And so there's not a single person in America who was not affected by this, the killing of Vincent Chin and the activism that came out of it.
Helen Zia remains an activist and is an award-winning journalist, and she now lives in California.
That report from the BBC's Farhana Haider. Up next, how an intimate relationship went from normal to wildly out of control.
On the surface, everything looked wonderful. So people were shocked when they found out what was really happening.
That story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As the federal budget for the new fiscal year is being crafted, agencies all across the country are waiting and wondering if their programs will be on the chopping block. And they're hoping a groundswell of public support will help convince Congress to spare their funding. One of the threatened programs is the USDA's Rural Development Office. It provides grants to businesses that support rural communities and residents. And as we're about to learn, small grants can make a big difference. Tim Irvin is with the Alliance for Economic Success, based in Manistee. It covers Manistee, Benzie, and Wexford counties. Tim Irvin, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your group works to connect communities and groups and people to resources like the USDA's Rural Development Office?
That's exactly right. And we are driven by local priorities and local goals. And so what we do is we try to make a match between those priorities and goals and resources that exist. And USDA Rural Development is absolutely fundamental to meeting the financial resource needs of many communities with regard to economic development, job creation.
I think a lot of people hear USDA and they think crop prices or, you know, livestock prices. But the USDA's Office for Rural Development is something very different, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. And the name itself, I think, is one that people struggle with. But rural development has over 50 financial assistance programs, all for rural applications. So they are absolutely vital to the rural economy, not only throughout the United States, but certainly in Michigan, providing everything from loan guarantees for business, direct loans to nonprofits to do things like purchase buildings and expand their operations, rehabilitating portions of communities and downtowns, developing economic development strategies for things like highway corridors, and the list goes on and on. So they are really an economic backbone for rural communities everywhere.
And I know there was already a degree of alarm as to the future of the Rural Development Office because the new Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue, already abolished that position of Undersecretary for Rural Development. So what's the proposed Trump budget? What could that mean to the Rural Development Office?
Well, we hate to even think of what it would mean. I mean, if we think about things that we're doing right now, for example, a new senior village, which would create a first for Northern Michigan by combining in one place services and programs for senior citizens, as well as senior housing. We are absolutely reliant upon USDA Rural Development for that project. We also have a large number of small communities that have issues with their wastewater treatment, sewer treatment. And I can tell you that USDA Rural Development, in almost every case, is the only viable source of funding for those small communities to meet those infrastructure requirements. In the case of Manistee, we restored a community theater, the Vogue Theater, through a feasibility study funded by USDA that showed that the theater could be restored. And that led to a process of raising over $2 million with 730 donors. And today, the theater's been open now for nearly 3 years. It's been profitable every month. It has changed the market dynamics of our downtown. Over 250,000 people in a community of 6,000 have gone to that theater, and the economic impact of a relatively small grant from rural development has been huge.
So the little amount that maybe, you know, on paper looks like a small grant, but it really had a big payoff.
It's all about leverage. And, you know, for example, we just received word that they have funded another grant application of ours, and this one is to connect private sector employers with high school students through a program we have here called Launch Manistee, which is about the success of kids and students and the economic growth of our community. And if anyone has talked with an employer in northern Michigan recently, it is almost a sure bet that they have heard about how they are struggling with filling their positions and finding quality employees. So, you know, if we look at things like the value of a small amount of money helping a large number of employers fill their positions and make their businesses viable, the impact is absolutely huge. And there really isn't any other source of funding than rural development that supports rural communities. So I think that, you know, the cuts that have been proposed show, a tremendous insensitivity to rural areas, not only in America, but certainly here in Michigan, and particularly in the areas that we work in, which are Manistee, Benzie, and Wexford County. It is hard for us to fathom how we would do our job in supporting economic development in the areas that we serve without rural development in place and fully funded.
And Tim, what kind of cuts for a rural development office are in the Trump budget?
It begins with a leadership position, and, you know, they have not yet filled the undersecretary position for rural development.
In fact, my understanding from what I've been reading is Secretary Perdue has abolished the position. It's not going to be filled.
Well, that's right.
Was there a line item, to your knowledge, in the Trump budget for rural development?
I haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it. I can tell you that even for the funds that have been appropriated, we are still waiting for Washington to make their allocation to the states. And, you know, for example, the senior project that we've got, which would provide for senior programs and services and senior housing, we've got everything set, everything mobilized to go. And so far, Washington has not transferred the funds into Michigan to enable that program to happen.
So what's the call to action here, Tim? What are you hoping concerned people will do?
Well, I think, you know, people, you know, local units of government, in particular, nonprofits, the organizations that have benefited from rural development are, it's hard to find one that hasn't. So they really need to contact their elected officials, their U.S. Senator and U.S. representatives, and make their feelings known about just how important rural development is to the economic well-being and quality of life in rural Michigan and rural America, which from a standpoint of geographic coverage and land is really the majority of the United States. So again, if we look at the amount of funding, this is it for rural areas in many, many ways, and particularly with regard to economic development. So if our administration is really going to place the kind of priority on economic development and job creation and building our small communities, this is where it needs to be done.
Tim Ervin, Alliance for Economic Success, based in Manistee. Thank you so much for talking with us, Tim.
Thank you very much.
Before we get into the next story, this is a warning. There are graphic descriptions of violence that might be difficult for some listeners to hear. Nicole Beverly was abused for years by her ex-husband, Kevin Beverly. He's now serving time for an aggravated stalking conviction. But He's scheduled to be released from the Newberry Correctional Facility on August 24th. And since her ex-husband went to prison, Nicole Beverly's been hearing that he's threatening to kill her, to kill their two teenage sons. He's allegedly tried to hire other inmates to do the job. With Kevin Beverly's parole date fast approaching, Nicole believes she must act quickly to save herself and her family. Nicole Beverly, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Can we go back to when you and Kevin first met and married? How long ago was that?
Well, we met in college. So we both attended Eastern Michigan. And when we first met, it was a normal dating relationship. Charming, funny, seemed like a great person. And back then, I didn't know the red flags to look for in dating in terms of someone with abusive personality. So the things that I thought were showing that he cared about me were more signs of jealousy and control. But it took me.
Such as? What kind of signs?
So early in the relationship, it would be he didn't like my friends or wouldn't want me spending time with my friends. He would contact me all the time. Where are you? Who are you with? If I did spend time with my friends, he'd be upset about it. But it was sporadic. There would be times when things were great also.
And you're in love.
Right.
So, yes. And that progressed. So you got married.
We did. We got married. We had our two children. And over time, the emotional abuse got more severe. So he would be controlling but also put me down a lot. So I'd have frequent put downs of being stupid, being ugly, being fat, being lazy. So my self-esteem got broken down. And then over time, the physical violence started to seep into the relationship where it would be if I did something he didn't like, he might push me or grab my arm. So then over time, the pushes got harder. He might push me down on the ground. And then there was a night in particular where he attacked me pretty brutally.
How?
Well, the situation that happened is my sons and I had come back from dinner. And we had a bird that was kept building a nest above our porch. And then the birds would poop on the porch. Mm-hmm. So he decided that he was going to knock the nest down and kill the baby birds. And my youngest son was devastated. He was crying. So I'd made the decision to take him to my mother's house. And my ex-husband wasn't having that. So he knew I was going to leave, and he reacted very strongly. And I could tell by the look in his eye that something very negative was going to happen because previous to this, the violence had been increasing. His threats had been increasing. And I attempted to leave because I knew. And as I was trying to flee from the garage, he grabbed me by my hair and pulled me back into the garage. I did yell for help. Several times, but he's 6'4". At that point in time, he was probably about 360 pounds. And he dragged me into the house and ordered our boys to go upstairs. And he proceeded to punch me, kick me. He jumped with his full weight on my ribs. He dragged me into our living room, kitchen area, which was open, and made me sit at the table. And he went into his office, which was one room over, and got his gun. And he told me if anyone had heard me yelling for help and had called the police, that he was going to shoot the officers that answered the door and then kill me. And then he proceeded to hold the gun to my head for I couldn't even tell you how long, because I just remember him telling me everything that was wrong with me and all the reasons he should kill me while he had held it to my head. And he ranted and raved. And I thought about running, but I knew I wouldn't have enough time that he would shoot me. Mm-hmm. He took my phone. He took my keys, which is what abusers typically do so that you can't leave or contact anyone for help. And he called me off work the following day, and I believe it was over a weekend. So there was a few days before I went back to work because I did have quite a few bruises. And the next morning when he got up, and of course I had to be in the same room with him at all times, he told me that I owed him an apology for almost making him kill me. And I knew that day that everything had changed and I wasn't going to get apologies anymore. He was getting something off of the power and control he had over me. And from that day forward, there were threats of if I told anyone what would happen to me, if I tried to leave him, what would happen to me.
And that's when you stop and go, did you think of calling the police? I'm sure you did, but then he's telling you, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill the police officer if somebody comes.
Right. And he kept my phone for several days, and he kept all the phones from the house. So there was no way I could call anyone. And his threats were very graphic in nature, that if I left, he was going to hunt me down, that he was going to slit my throat, that he was going to shoot me and paralyze me, that he was going to throw acid in my face, that no matter how far I went, he was going to track me down. And I knew that he was serious, and I knew he was capable of doing those things. So it took me 4 months before I told anyone what was happening.
And what year was this?
This was in 2009.
All right. So how did you get out of the marriage?
So I eventually, after about 4 months, told my mom what was happening and contacted Safe House.
Had she guessed?
No, she had no idea.
Really? All that time it had been ramping up.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, like, I think she recognized that he was emotionally abusive, but I think the physical abuse was a surprise to her and everyone that we knew, because on the surface, we had a beautiful home, we had nice cars, we had beautiful children. On the surface, everything looked wonderful. So people were shocked when they found out what was really happening.
So you tell your mom, and this is 4 months after this terrible, terrible episode you described. What did it take to get away from this man who said, no matter where you go, I'll follow you?
So I called Safe House also and got information about creating a safety plan. And what I started to do was to copy documents, important documents, when he was at work, because I knew once I left, I would never get them. I took a few things out of the house at a time, clothing for the children, clothing for myself. And then I had been told that if I wanted any pictures, if there's anything irreplaceable, I needed to get it out before I left because I would never see it again. And that ended up being absolutely true, because most of my belongings were gone when I was finally able to get into the house to retrieve them. So over a few weeks' time, I did that, and I filed for a personal protection order. And the day that the personal protection order was approved, I picked up the kids from school and we went to my sister's house in Canada for 2 weeks to, you know, stay safe and assess the situation.
What finally landed him in prison?
So it was quite a lead up. Once I left, things really didn't improve. There was in a domestic violence charge where he came to my home, attempted to enter my home once I had left and was renting a house. And he threw a cigarette in my face. I called 911, and the charge was domestic violence. He ended up being put on probation. And then from that point, it was probation violation after personal protection order violation. There was then an aggravated stalking charge that got pled down to a stalking charge. Then there was the most recent charge in 2012 for aggravated stalking that actually stayed an aggravated stalking charge.
What happened in Oakland County during that aggravated stalking charge in 2012?
So when I had reported to his probation officer that he was threatening me, I actually had text messages and voice recordings of the threats. I was instructed that when he reported for probation that they were going to arrest him and charge him again with violating probation and personal protection order. So I got a phone call, and I was assuming that the phone call was going to be say, yep, you know, it's okay, we've arrested him, because I was living in fear at that time. I was constantly looking over my shoulder. I had to know where exits were at all times, which I still do. And the phone call that I got was not stating that they had arrested him. The phone call that I got was that when the probation officers went to arrest him, they told him why and that he fought them off and fled the building, and they did not know his whereabouts. And I then had to file my own police report before anyone would take action to try and help us. And my children and I had to leave our home for 5 days. And finally, Washtenaw County authorized a SWAT team to look for him. They were unable to locate him. And on the fifth day, they authorized U.S. Marshals, and the U.S. Marshals were able to find him in Dearborn.
And Kevin Beverly was finally in prison, but that did not end the nightmare for Nicole Beverly.
Two inmates came forward at Jackson Prison writing letters stating that my ex-husband was on a regular basis saying that as soon as he got out, he was going to come to my home and kill my children in front of me.
Tomorrow, we continue the conversation with Nicole, discussing the threats that keep coming at her and at her sons and why she's decided to take drastic action. That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.